We want to be looking at your circadian biology. So things like what time you go to sleep at. If you're a night owl, your cortisol levels the next day are going to be really low. If you're snacking at night, like if you're eating at night, cortisol levels are going to be low the next day. You know, medications like things like antidepressants will alter your cortisol. They will lower them.
I've been fighting with one arm tied behind my back. But what happens when I'm finally set free?
What are we doing live? Echoes in eternity.
It's supposed to be hard. If it wasn't hard, everyone would do it. The hard is what makes it great.
Only love can truly save the world. This is my mission now, forever.
Happy New Year, and welcome to another episode of Better with Dr. Stephanie. I am your host, Dr. Stephanie Estima. This is our second AMA. So we talked a lot about hormones. That was the topic du jour. And the questions that we received from our Facebook community were almost exclusively centered around cortisol, stress, inflammation. And we also talked about a lot of, about menstruation and how to really understand how varying levels of hormonal fluctuations during your cycle can influence your mood, your energy, what type of exercises you should be doing, what type of, you know, nutritional protocols you can be doing, etc. So I start off by just explaining the normal cortisol pattern, the fallacy around the diagnosis of, or, you know, it's not really a diagnosis, but when we talk about adrenal fatigue and why it's important to understand that. And we get into mitochondrial energy and function. We talk about the three main things that really drive energetic production. We talk about, you know, fuel substrates. So whether you are getting, you know, energy from your diet, or if you're fasting, you're getting energy from your constitution. We talked about hormonal regulation, and we talked about enzymatic concentration as well. And did a lot on cortisol. So how to know when it's high, how to know when it's low, what the optimal curve is, what that's predictive of, and went into, like I mentioned, you know, we had a question come in around spotting and not really knowing when her menstruation starts. We talked about how to get rid of belly fat if you have low cortisol levels, what might be some of the contributing factors to that, and much, much more. So we are recording this just before the new year, and I'm moving this production up so that it is the first episode of 2020. And you will notice that my voice is much, dare I say, sexier, but much more throaty and sultry. And that is because I feel myself fighting whatever virus has been kind of making its rounds. So I am doubling down on my tea, my supplements, and my fasting. So hopefully in the next couple of weeks, you will see a resurgence of my voice, because as we went and we talked for probably an hour 20, an hour 30, my voice progressively got lower and lower and lower. So enjoy. It does sound really good, but it does mean that I'm coming down with something. So without further ado, please enjoy our second AMA with Stephanie Major. One of my goals this year is to make it my best year ever with my skin. And one of the ways that I'm doing that is with the Boncharge Red Light Neck and Chest Mask. Wrinkles, acne, scarring, skin roughness, loss of collagen and elastin happen in the face and in the neck and the décolletage area on our chest, where the skin is very thin and susceptible to skin damage. I think at this point, we're all pretty good about putting sunscreen on our face, but so many of us miss the neck and the chest area too. I use the Boncharge neck and chest mask daily for about 10 minutes in the morning while I'm checking emails. Their red and near infrared light waves together penetrate up to 5 to 10 centimeters below the skin surface. The red light reaches the skin's top layers, and the NIR light targets the deeper tissues without UV exposure. And that's going to help reduce the fine lines, wrinkles, and to help ramp up collagen and elastin production. So I want you to head over and have your best skin with me this year. Go to boncharge.com/better. That's BETTER. And use the discount code BETTER at checkout. And that's going to give you 15% off your entire cart.
Transform your health and fitness with the Carol Bike, the smartest, most effective exercise backed by science. You can experience unparalleled results in just a minimum of 15 minutes per week. per week, thanks to AI personalized workouts tailored to your age and your fitness level. You will increase fat loss, train up your strength and your speed, and have better energy, something that every woman, including myself, absolutely covets. I always say that women are the original biohackers. If there's a way for us to feel better and look better, we are all over it. Carol Bike, in my opinion, is one of the best pieces of cardio equipment that you can invest in. Studies prove that Carol helps you achieve a 12% increase in cardio fitness, lowers the risk of type 2 diabetes by 62%, and reduces blood pressure by 5% in as little as 8 weeks. Begin your transformation with the Carol Bike today and enjoy $100 off using the promo code BETTER for our beautiful Better Podcast listeners. That's BETTER. All you have to do is visit carolbike.com.
All right. Welcome back. This is AMA number 2. I have my partner in crime, the Major, otherwise known as Stephanie Major, here with me. Welcome back.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be back. Episode number 2.
Yeah, this is going to be a good one. And you all get the pleasure of enjoying my phone voice because I can feel myself, my kids, my family, everyone's been sick over the holidays. And now I'm starting to get my voice gets the telltale sign for me is my voice gets deeper and deeper and deeper. So I can tell that my voice is a bit more sultry and a bit more, you know, velvety, but I'm going to murder this virus, but I can feel my throat starting to get a little itchy.
Yes, I actually had the same thing going on. So we have our matching cup of teas today that we'll just be sipping through. Being here for the second time makes me think of this really great joke by Chris Rock, where he says that when you're meeting someone for the first time, you're never actually meeting them. You're meeting the representative. So thank you so much for having my representative on the first AMA, but I'm here as me today.
I love it.
Vibrant and alluring. And I use those words purposely because you and I have picked our words for 2020.
Oh, yeah.
Right? This is the first episode going out in the new year. You, for the past couple of years, have been my fairy planner godmother.
We started with Passion Planner, right? We started being the Passion Planner. And now this year, we've switched to Danielle Laporte's Desire Map Planner.
Okay, so you have to tell your audience about your words because they are such juicy, good words. What are your 5 core desired feelings for 2020?
So this is such a good question. Danielle is so brilliant because when I first picked up this planner, I was like, okay, let's see what this is about. I love Danielle. I love everything she does. So she has this brilliant process where you go through all these different categories in your life and you say, how do I want to feel at work? How do I want to feel with my personal relationship? How do I want to feel in my spiritual life, my financial life, my intellectual life, all these different categories. And she gives you these samples of words to choose. And so I wrote probably for each category, 20 or 30 words in terms of how I wanted to feel, how I wanted to be showing up. Mm-hmm. And I looked for patterns. So I was like, okay, what are the repeating words in each of those, you know, categories? And the words that I came up with are luminous, limitless, glamorous, strong, and confident. So glamorous might not be, you know, maybe not in my work world or maybe, but strong, confident, limitless. I can see myself showing up as the best version of myself at work, you know, in my personal relationship, you know, luminous and glamorous and strong and confident. Like those words really apply to every area of my life.
I love that. Glamorous just adds a romantic feeling to everything that you're doing. It's a great word.
Yeah.
Go.
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, for me too, there's been a bit of a falling back in love in 2019. So falling back in love with the red lips, falling back in love with, you know, doing, you know, getting glamorous and doing my makeup and all those kinds of things. So it's going to be great for 2020. What about you? What were your words? I know we've talked about the two, like alluring. Right. What were your words?
Yes. And thank you. You're the one that suggested alluring for me. And at first I had a visceral reaction to that word. I'm like, I don't know. But when you look at the word and it means magnetic and charismatic, and when you take a deeper dive on the word, I was like, okay, this is a great word. So I have vibrant, alluring, authentic, empowered, and loved.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah. Okay. And you, I feel like those are already you, but I love why Danielle is such a genius is you just say, okay, how do I want to show up as the best version of myself today? And you use that word almost like very similar to Todd's alter ego, right? Like, how do I want to show up as Wonder Woman? How do I want to show up as alluring? How do I want to show up as vibrant, you know, glamorous, limitless, luminous, you know, whatever the word is. So, yeah.
Okay. Well, we have a big topic to cover today, and I saw all of your notes and the preparation that you were doing. So why don't you just start talking about this topic that you are so passionate about?
You mean the 21 pages of notes that I made in the shared Google Doc that we have? Yeah. Just a little bit of prep. Okay. So most of the questions, so in our Facebook community, it's a free Facebook community, by the way, this is where we draw our AMA questions from. So if you are listening to this and you have a question that you want me to answer, it is a free Facebook community. It's called the Better Community. And every month we will post, you know, you kind of get insider stuff in the Facebook community. So highly recommend joining that. But we farmed all of our questions around hormones. We said, okay, we're going to do a thing on hormones. We know that we're going to talk about menstruation. We know we're going to talk about women. What are the questions that you want? And overwhelmingly, actually surprisingly, I was surprised by this. I thought we were going to talk about a lot of estrogen stuff. And I thought we were going to talk about thyroid. I thought those were going to be the big stars of the show. But what ended up happening was the cortisol, the stress, how do I lower cortisol? What's going on with my adrenals, sleep? All of these things came up. So I want to pre-frame before we get into the questions, because there were so many on cortisol and stress and inflammation, the word adrenal fatigue was dropped a couple of times. So I want to just be a little bit of a nerd and talk about why it's why nomenclature is really important. So, you know, the words that we use really matter. And I want to talk about when we're thinking about cortisol, first we have to understand the way that it fluctuates during the day. So there's a diurnal or like a circadian rhythm, a diurnal rhythm to cortisol, and then how it interplays with things like sleep, you know, how other hormones come into play with it, pregnenolone, progesterones, et cetera. So if you can just give me like a couple of minutes as a runway before we take off, because I think that this will be really useful for the listener in terms of understanding cortisol in general.
I am so ready. Go ahead.
All right. So first thing I just want to say is when we think about human health, it is very easy to get very mechanistic about it. We want to just go in and pluck out the hormone, you know, divorce it from its surroundings and its interactions and study and say, how can we fix, you know, cortisol? How can we fix estrogen? How can we fix whatever the problem is? And it is very much you fail when you do that. We really want to be thinking about the forest from the trees. You can't just isolate cortisol in isolation. You can't just isolate estrogen in isolation or whatever hormone or whatever condition or disease you are thinking about. There are multiple interactions. We want to look at the forest from the trees as well as the individual trees themselves, so to speak. And when we think about the word adrenal fatigue, this is, again, nomenclature really matters. And, you know, I have been a card carrying member of the adrenal fatigue team. I've used that term before because it is sometimes easier to say to somebody, okay, these sound like it's a cluster of symptoms that the patient is typically describing. They're typically talking about things like needing to snack frequently, needing to, you know, feeling tired and wired, like this problem of falling asleep and staying asleep in the evening. You know, weight gain through the belly, particularly like we tend to see like weight gain through the waist area, brain fog, lack of energy in the morning. Like Giovanni and I have worked really hard on this because he would wake up, you know, at 8, let's say, and at 9:30 or 10, he'd be like, God, I need a nap. So, you know, he used to say, God, like my adrenals, they're shot. So you might look at those things and say, okay, it's my adrenals that are shot. But on a cellular level, what we're really talking about is the ability for your body to produce energy. So we're talking about the mitochondria. We're talking about the efficiency or lack thereof of their ability to produce energy. So, you know, bringing you back to your nightmares to, you know, high school human biology, mitochondria, air quotes, powerhouse of the cell, they produce ATP, which is we are producing ATP every single second, you know, that we've been talking, we are producing ATP. So we want to be thinking about mitochondrial efficiency, circadian rhythm and biology, and how that can potentiate cortisol and how that can affect essentially other hormones and their regulation or dysregulation. So when we're thinking about cortisol, I want you to not think about, oh, I have too high or too low cortisol, or what I want you to think more about the curve. So this is actually really, really important. When we're thinking about cortisol, it has a circadian flow or an ebb and flow to it. So in the morning, we have, so when we think about the cortisol, it's like a slope. So it's at its peak or at its zenith. You know, the most you'll ever have it is, you know, about 20 to 30 minutes after waking. And that's called the cortisol awakening response, or CAR. And from there, there's like a stepwise attenuation over the course of the day, meaning that over the course of the day, you're going to get a decrease in cortisol as the day goes on, so that in the evening time, you should have pretty low cortisol, and that's going to help coordinate with other sleep hormones like adenosine and melatonin in order to initiate sleep.
Can it go back up throughout the day, or it always its maximum is? So if you've had a, you know, an intense meeting or something stressful has happened, does your cortisol then go up, or does it continue to go down?
That's a great question. So what I'm describing is what we would like to see. So we like to see almost like a ski slope. We want to see high in the morning and then low, 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 like kind of, you know, progressive decrease over the course of the day. Mm-hmm. What I have found, especially with moms, so this is really interesting, around 3 or 4 o'clock, cortisol spikes. Why? Kids are coming home. Kids are coming home, right? Or, you know, you can see someone who has late meetings, you can see that cortisol spike. So it is absolutely possible to see cortisol spike if you've had a really you've had a really stressful fight with someone. You know, your body is going to prime itself. Cortisol is part of this sympathetic nervous system. So you are going to increase your sympathetic tone with stressors. So, and that, and good and bad stressors. So, you know, with exercise, your cortisol is going to get jacked. You know, with a fight with your loved one, or a really stressful meeting, or, you know, kids are doing something that they shouldn't, whatever, your cortisol is going to go, is going to fluctuate. But what we want to be working on is normalizing the slope. That shouldn't be happening every single day. Mm-hmm. And I'm doubling down on the slope because it's predictive of longevity. Like the slope in and of itself is predictive of your lifespan, so how long you're going to live, cardiovascular disease, and Alzheimer's, among other things. So it's really important for us to get the cortisol slope looking. It's almost like a hollowed out C, right? It almost looks like a C, or like I call it a ski slope.
It's the new sexy curve is your...
The new sexy curve. You got it. Exactly. So just to come back to that nervous system for a moment, the thing that I want everybody to remember about cortisol and stress, and this is where I think we forget this, is it is a counter-regulatory hormone. A lot of us think, oh, I'm stressed, my cortisol, and that's why I'm overweight. Cortisol is actually designed to counteract the effects of insulin. So cortisol and a couple other hormones, epinephrine, which is commonly referred to as adrenaline, growth hormone, glucagon, these are designed to defend against hypoglycemia. So insulin is supposed to take the blood glucose and shove it in the cell. Cortisol is going to defend against that. So when you are having a fight with your loved one, or your kid is, you know, driving you up the wall or what have you, you are going to see things like increase in your blood glucose, because that's cortisol getting the glucose or defending against insulin so that you can get that glucose into the periphery, into the muscles, so you can fight or flight. You can either fight the impending, you know, stress, or you can run away from it. So that's really important to remember. And with cortisol and with this stress response, the idea around it is it's supposed to be short-lived. So you're supposed to have, you know, the tiger, you know, the proverbial tiger that, you know, pops up in front of you. It's supposed to be a short thing. You either are going to win against a tiger or you're not. We're not designed to constantly be activating that stress response. That increase in sympathetic tone over time really leads to this chronic low-grade stress, or, you know, I use inflammation and stress really interchangeably. So chronic low-grade inflammation, and that affects the cortisol curve. I just wanted to talk about that. And I also, if I can, just add in a wrinkle, because all healthcare is not so straightforward. It would be so great if we could just say, oh, well, we just got to optimize the cortisol curve. Sometimes I've had many, many patients who check off all the subjective boxes. So they are tired and wired, need coffee all the time, belly weight, salt cravings, you know, blood sugar dysregulation, but we look at their cortisol and it's normal. So it's not necessarily always cortisol. It can be, but the other thing we want to be thinking about, especially as it relates to brain fog and having some women will describe like very poor resilience, like they can't handle a lot of stress because they already feel so stressed. We want to be thinking about energy. We want to be thinking about this on a cellular level. We want to be thinking about this in terms of our mitochondria, because those are, like I mentioned before, the thing that actually produces the energy that we have. So if you are feeling brain fogged, you know, tired and wired, you need external or exogenous sources like caffeine to kind of get you going. It may not necessarily be that your cortisol is not working the way that it should. It may be that your capacity, like your mitochondrial efficiency, may be jacked. And we can kind of go on, you know, a geeky magic carpet ride with things that affect energy production. We can kind of get into it, but you know, essentially the things that are going to affect your energy are kind of three main categories, and we're going to talk about all of them today. One is your substrate availability, how much food, you know, both external and internal food that you have. So when I say internal food, I mean fat, like excess adiposity. Mm-hmm. Hormonal regulation. So does your insulin have an appropriate response to blood glucose? Does your glucagon have an, you know, appropriate response to a fall in blood glucose? And then your genetics, really, like enzymatic modification. So what is the structure of the enzyme that's driving forward the process for making ATP, and how, and the concentration of that? So I pre-frame all of this kind of sciencey, nerdy goodness because I think it'll put the questions, how I answer the questions, in context. We want to be thinking about cortisol, but we also want to be thinking about other things like the other hormones that are designed to counteract insulin. We want to be thinking about mitochondrial efficiency, oxidative stress, and chronic low-grade inflammation.
Okay, so we're going to start with a question from Ashley, who is in Phoenix, Arizona. A personal question to you about fasting. How do you incorporate a whole food cooked dinner on TRE? For instance, my fiance and I are medical professionals and do not get off work until 7 p.m. We start our day 6 a.m. and can put off eating our first meals until later. But as for getting home and throwing together a dinner, we often end up eating around 9 p.m., which feels too close to bedtime when you're aiming for a 10 to 11 p.m. bedtime to wake up at 6 a.m. Even with food prep, should we just give up sharing a meal together and eat dinner at work? I'm just wondering how others accomplish this and whether we should just stop correlating food with being social during the work week.
That's a great question. I would say that there's a couple different options here, and they may or may not be relevant, or they may or may not work for her, depending on, you know, her lifestyle. One, it may be possible that you can give up correlating food with being social during the work week. You know, maybe you make time with your husband to have purposeful, you know, connection and communication over the weekend when you have a little bit more time. If you want to try and play around with it, there's two things that I thought of when I read this question. One is invest in a crock pot. So that has been, I mean, you've been over to the house, Major. You know how often this thing is used. It is probably my most used appliance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I throw like my frozen meat. I get my meat delivered from a company we're in Canada. So we use, or in Ontario, we use True Local, which is, you know, grass-fed, grass-finished meats, all that stuff. So I will take it from the freezer, throw it in the crock pot, along with some bone broth. And then, you know, a couple minutes before dinner time, I'll just throw in some chopped, you know, broccoli or carrots or, you know, whatever it is, so they can steam lightly, just so they're a little bit softer, and then serve it in the stew. And also, I was very Italian this year. I made my own tomato sauce with one of my friends, Maria Cristina, and we made it at her house, like on her driveway. So I have like 48 bottles of tomato sauce. So I'll just throw the tomato sauce in with the frozen meat, and then it's kind of done. So that might help with your food prep, so that maybe you're eating closer to 8 o'clock versus 9 if you're trying to get to bed by 10. So it gives you that still that 2 hour window where your stomach can empty, and that'll help facilitate a better quality of sleep. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I thought of, and I don't know if this is available to her, but she can flip her meal times altogether. So I know that she's trying to get time with the hubby at the end of the day. So she's trying to get the meal at the end of the day together. She can try to have the first meal of the day. So flip her eating schedule such that she's eating her breakfast with her husband, and then they can fast, you know, they can have lunch, you know, separately, but then in the evening they're fasting. So there's no need to rush in and, you know, get something on the table. And then there can be really like connection time. You can be talking, you can be having sex, you can, you know, all these different, you know, things that are important that we tend to forget with our partners through the hustle and bustle of the work week. So those would be my two suggestions. And if either of those are not really viable, then I would say you know, make sure that you are spending some time on the weekend for meaningful connection with your partner. If doing it in a social way is important for you.
I love those suggestions. Okay. The next one from Sarah is, I'll take any advice you've got on cortisol. I know it's highest in the morning and one should hold off their first cup of caffeine so as not to coincide with its zenith. What other pearls might you have specifically on how to lower it other than meditation, mindfulness, adaptogens?
Okay. So this is why I had that long preamble, because we're kind of getting into these cortisol questions now. Like I said before, cortisol is going to be highest, you know, within the first 20 or 30 minutes of waking. That's your CAR, your cortisol awakening response. You don't actually want to lower that. So I think her question was, how can we lower it in the morning? You don't want to do that. You want your cortisol to be at its highest point, at its peak, the zenith in the morning, and then you want it to come down after that. When I read her question, I think the spirit of the question is around stress management. Like, how do I lower my cortisol? How do I lower my stress management? And this is where we want to be engaging in a different type of stress, that eustress, eustress, you meaning good for you stress, and lowering distress and inflammation. So saying this another way, the morning would be a great time to prime and adhere to the concept of a hormetic stress, meaning a stress but for resiliency and adaptation for the mitochondria. So we might say that, you know, if you put those two words together, we're talking about mitohormesis or a mitohormetic effect. So a couple ways to do this, depending on your capacity, depending on your tolerance and your resilience, it might mean taking a really cold shower in the morning, or at least making the last minute of your shower really, really cold, because that is, you know, any extremes in temperature, whether it be heat or cold, is a stressor to our mitochondria. So we are going to make them stronger over the long term. So I really like to, you know, have a normal shower, but then that last minute, all the heat goes off. So it's almost like jumping in a lake. Like if you've ever gone north in the summertime, you're at a cottage or something, and you just jump that first jump in the lake, you're like, oh my
God. Hurts so good.
It hurts so good. Exactly. I would say other things like exercise would be another hormetic stress. So it's a good stress. Breathing techniques like Wim Hof breathing techniques, so you're oxygenating your body, and maybe it's fasting as well. Like maybe you're skipping breakfast, maybe you're a little bit hungry, you start eating, you know, at noon, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, that kind of thing. I'm not such a big fan on adaptogens, especially in the morning. You don't necessarily want to lower things in the morning. And what I was sort of leaning to towards, you know, someone who wakes up with really low energy. So this is something that Giovanni has struggled with, you know, for years. I mean, he's much, much better now, but we want to be looking at why your cortisol levels are low, if they are low. Because sometimes someone could be, you can have completely normal cortisol levels. Like I was saying, it's just your mitochondria are not functioning well. But if we do test, you know, salivary or urine testing, and we see that your cortisol levels are low, we want to be looking at your circadian biology. So things like what time you go to sleep at. If you're a night owl, your cortisol levels the next day are going to be really low. If you're snacking at night, like if you're eating at night, cortisol levels are going to be low the next day. You know, medications, like things like antidepressants will alter your cortisol. They will lower them. Poor sleep lowers your cortisol. And even things like being overweight, like having excess adiposity or excess fat on the body is going to have a lower, you are going to see when we take that cortisol measurement in that first 20 or 30 minutes, we're going to see that those levels are low. So that would be the same principles really do apply. We want to be working on mitochondrial efficiency and also working on lifestyle factors that are going to help your hormonal regulation. So reducing your excess adiposity, making sure that your circadian biology is on point, stop eating in the evening, that kind of stuff.
Okay. Now we're going to ask, what's your preferred method for hormone testing? Dutch test or serum panels?
I like both. I think the more information you have, the better you can constellate patterns. Of course, it always depends on the person who is, you know, the patient in front of me and what their goals are. Because you can look at some of the other things. You can look at some organic acid tests. So you can look at other things that affect energy. You can look at methylmalonic acid. You can look at B6, you know, hormonal variants. You can look at cortisol versus cortisone. So I like the Dutch. It's one of my favorites. But I also, you know, like I said, depending on the woman or the man who I'm working with, I'll also look at genetic reports as well. So I want to know how efficient or inefficient the gene is at its conversion. So we said before, when we're thinking about energy, substrate availability, hormones, and enzymatic modification, you know, the genetic and epigenetic expression of that gene is going to be important. So if there's a woman who, you know, we're suspecting PCOS, for example, I want to understand how quickly her progesterone changes to her testosterone, and then how quickly her testosterone is being converted, if at all, to dihydroxytestosterone or DHT, the super testosterone. So I might look at, you know, CYP17A1, like I might look at the SNPs, you know, CYP17A1 or SRD5A2. These are like different genetic SNPs that are going to tell me how efficient or inefficient she is at moving this along the pathway. Same thing with estrogen. I want to know, you know, what her preferential, you know, when we're thinking about the protective versus, you know, the DNA damaging estrogens, I'm going to want to know genetically what her predisposition is so that I can kind of create protocols for her. So I guess that's a long way of answering and saying, I like it all.
I like And the good thing about the genetic testing as well as the Dutch is that they can do it at home. So you don't have to go to a clinic and have them draw blood. It's just, if you want to skip that one step, you're able to, you know what, get it done, mail it away, get some information.
It's like, it's in a self-address stamped envelope. Yeah. Like, it's so easy, you know? And it's like, you don't have to wait in line and, you know,
Okay. So Jenny's asking, cortisol, how to know if you have high cortisol, how to lower it? When should it be high and when should it be low? JJ Virgin, I think, is one of the people that I've heard say women shouldn't do intermittent fasting in the morning. The women should eat right after they get up because it'll mess up their cortisol.
Yeah, so I think we've talked about when it's high and when it's low. So we've done that, you know, that ski slope. We've answered that already. JJ Virgin, one of my mentors, she is a unique animal. I don't think I've met anyone exactly like her. She has the fortitude. She's actually going to be on the podcast. We were emailing the other day and I was like, you got to come on. You got to talk about your mindset because it is something to be witnessed. Like her, she is just Teflon. She's amazing. Mm-hmm. So I've had a lot of discussions with her around intermittent fasting and the ketogenic diet, because those are two things that I really talk about a lot in terms of the changing the constitution of, you know, in terms of female physiology and hormones and adiposity and weight loss and stuff. And for her constitution specifically, what we've talked about is she does not like to do long fasts. So she has, I don't know, 1% body fat, you know, something like she's like lean all year round. Like you know, I probably sit at around 17%, maybe 18% body fat when I'm watching my diet. And if I want to get, you know, if I want to kind of enter into sort of the competition zone, like I have to really watch my diet and work out and all that kind of stuff. She's pretty, like, I think she hangs around at like 14 or 15% body fat without even trying. Like she's unbelievable. So for her, long-term fasts are really, she doesn't do well on them. So she likes to, her type of fasting is a daily time-restricted eating. So she will maybe skip breakfast or she will skip dinner. You know, she travels a lot. So kind of depending on, you know, where she is. So she will only intermittent fast, but she won't do anything more than that because her constitution doesn't really allow for that. Mm-hmm. For the most part, I mean, if we were all like JJ, we would all be better off because she's got muscle, she's lean, she's got the mindset, like she is whip smart. So I would say for the most of the population, intermittent fasting is a great idea. So restricting your, you know, when we talk about TRE, restricting your eating window. Mm-hmm. I read somewhere, it was crazy. It was something like, it was an American stat. It was Americans, the only time that Americans fast is when they're sleeping. It was like something like they're eating from like the minute they wake up to the minute they go to sleep. And, you know, you can make the argument around sleep. Like we're not even sleeping as much as we should, right? We're only sleeping like 6 hours, 5 hours, whatever. Yeah. So JJ, the type of keto that I employ is something that's very much aligned with her. So, you know, the lots of green leafy vegetables as the base, lots of, you know, meat, like good quality meats and, you know, fat as well. But she doesn't do long-term fast because she just doesn't have the body fat to sustain it.
Right. Okay. So, and Jenny also asked how to know if you have high cortisol. So that is with the testing, right?
Yeah. So that would be with the testing. So like you would either do I'd probably do the Dutch. And we would want to, like, one of the things we have to be really, really, really mindful of when you're doing any type of testing is the timing, because cortisol changes all day long. So if you take a test, you know, your first, you know, if you're doing salivary cortisol, you have to do it within the first 20 minutes of waking up. Same thing. You have to also note the time of day when you're doing the Dutch, which is it's a dried urine. So it's a urine test. So you're basically peeing on a piece of paper, and then you send it off to the lab for analysis.
All right. So John from Canada says, what is the relationship between sleep optimization and hormone optimization?
Oh, so much. So much. I often will joke that you can do everything right. You can have all the eating, you can do all the exercising, you can do all the meditation. If you're not sleeping well, it doesn't matter. Like, you can't be healthy. It's the first domino. So when we think about lack of sleep, and when I say lack of sleep, I mean less than 7 hours. Mm-hmm. So that's another really important thing as well. For some reason in our culture, we fetishize this idea of, oh, I can just get by on 6, or I can do 5. And you've heard like presidents talk, like I think Ronald Reagan, I think Margaret Thatcher has talked about it. I think even, you know, the current president, or is he the president anymore? Is he impeached? I don't know. Something. Donald Trump, I think he's talked about it as well.
TBD.
TBD. They talk about this ability to just go on 5 hours of sleep, and they're like, oh, I'm fine. It's like, you're actually not fine. You know, because what happens is you become much more driven by the sympathetic nervous system. So that fight or flight response that we talked about earlier. And we see hormonal changes as well. So we become much more, like our fuel partitioning becomes much worse. When you have poor sleep, less than 7 hours, you are going to increase your resting energetic expenditure. So you're also going to be increasing your respiratory quotient, which is your RQ is basically the way that they determine it. Like, they put a mask on your face and they determine how much carbon dioxide to oxygen ratio you're breathing in and out. And from that, they can determine how much carbohydrates you're burning, how much proteins and fats. So the measurements that they use is 0.7 is you're primarily using fats, 0.8 or 9 is proteins, and 1 is carbohydrate. So as you decrease your sleep, the more you turn into a carbohydrate burning machine and not a fat burning machine. You become much more glycolytic. Your beta oxidative capacity reduces, which is how we burn our fat. Your insulin gets jacked. So we have lots of, like, so you look almost diabetic. If we were to take a look at your blood glucose, your insulin levels in your blood, you have a tendency to eat more carbohydrates. Like, have you ever had like a night where you haven't slept well, and the next day you're like, all the carbs.
Oh, yes. Yep.
Give me all the carbs. Mm-hmm. And then all your hormones. We get like your thyroid hormones get jacked, your leptin levels. Your leptin is your satiety hormone. So that actually lowers. The less sleep you have, the more hungry, like the less full you feel. And then ghrelin, which is sort of the other side of that, which is your sort of signals when you're hungry, that will get jacked up. Cortisol levels go up. Your sex hormones, they go down. So your testosterones, estrogens, progesterones are... at the expense of producing more cortisol, we have less of those sex hormones being produced. So there's a really intimate connection between sleep and hormones. And whenever I'm working with, particularly women, I always joke, it's like the cheapest diet. Like, before you start engaging with me, with the Estima diet, with the Estima protocol, just sleep for 8 hours a night for a week.
Okay, but what about the woman that's going, Dr. Stephanie, I'm trying. I'm going to bed. I'm trying to get sleep, but I keep waking up and I can't go back to sleep quickly. What does that woman do? She wants sleep. What does she do?
So we're going to link out to my article, the Sleep Your Way to the Top, because I go through 21 ways there. But there's a couple of ways that we can think about developing healthy sleep habits. One is stress management. So I know that it's really easy to be like, reduce your stress, but you know, really have the courage to look at where your stressors are coming from. Chiropractors talk about stress in 3 different dimensions. And you know, this can be extrapolated. It's not just chiropractors that talk about this. A lot of people do, but I grew up in chiropractic. So we talk about, you know, physical stressors. We talk about chemical stressors that can be, you know, environmental toxins, diet, and emotional stressors. These things all jack up your sympathetics. So if you are constantly, like if you don't take care of your, you know, your posture or your nagging low back pain, you develop these compensatory patterns, you have chronic low-grade inflammation in the physical realm. If you have a pro-inflammatory diet, or you've been exposed to mold and you don't know it, or you know, this, you know, you constantly are putting on toxic makeup and you're eating your food out of plastics, and you are going to be jacking up your chemical stressors. Same is true for your emotional. Like, if you experience trauma, however you want to define that as a child, if you were, you know, treated poorly as a child, as an adolescent, physical abuse, mental abuse, sexual abuse, or even if it's just, it doesn't have to be that extreme, any sort of trauma that you've endured, that you have not dealt with still lives today in your nervous system. Mm-hmm. So having the courage to lean into that would be, that's probably its own topic. It's probably its own podcast.
Such a sexy topic. I love this. We have to do an entire episode about sleep and
But I think that the blue blocking, like, so if you start doing simple things like blue blocking glasses, particularly in the evening, like if you're on, watching TV or you're on your device, you're on your phone, wearing, and we'll put a link. I think I have a True Dark discount. Mm-hmm. It's like 10%. I'll put it in the show notes for people if they want to look at it. Things like making your bedroom cold. So in the article, I talk about, you know, getting your bedroom to like 65 degrees Fahrenheit or 15 degrees centigrade, or even using things like the chili pad. I love this thing. So, and for like like postmenopausal women, it's like a godsend. If you're hot and having hot flashes overnight, this chili pad is going to save you. Yeah. So that would be, and I would also say, you know, making sure that your electrolytes are balanced as well. That's another really big thing. You know, we want to be making sure that we're having salt. It's been demonized. We talk about like, oh, we'll have to reduce my salt. No, have some Himalayan salt in your water. Like, you need salt.
Love salt. Okay.
I love salt. Salt over everything.
Mm-hmm. I am incredibly bullish on sauna as a therapy for recovery, heart health, and overall aging well. I personally decided on an infrared sauna from Sunlighten because of the range of far wavelengths and near infrared wavelengths that it offers. Saunas help with detoxification and rejuvenation to rid your body of toxins. It helps with heart health by improving circulation, reducing blood pressure, and helping keep the arteries supple. It helps with muscle recovery by easing the tension and soreness to recover faster. And of course, stress reduction. With the warmth and the relaxation of sitting in a sauna, it's crucial for hormonal balance and achieving a state of well-being necessary for a strong physique and a strong mind. If you visit sunlighten.com/better and use code better to get a discount, that is sunlighten, sunlighten.com/better, and use code better at checkout.
Really interested in the relationship between HIIT and cortisol. I'm seeing a lot of people, especially those post 45, that are doing HIIT daily or 5 times per week.
Oh, that's a gym, F45.
Oh, is it?
I think it's a gym, yeah.
Okay, right, F45. That are doing HIIT daily or 5 times per week. My understanding is that this would not be healthy and leave us with constant stress levels, especially if we have a high stress lifestyle. Thoughts? Mm-hmm. My background, I was doing HIIT for every workout and was addicted to the rush, but I could not shift belly fat. Stress hormones or being a twin mom?
I was so happy to see this question come in because I have been waiting for an opportunity to talk about muscles.
There it is. So, that's your runway. Go.
So when we think about the type of muscles that we utilize when we are doing high intensity interval training, it is very different. Let me back up one more second. We have three different main types of muscles. We have type 1 muscles, we have type 2A and type 2B. Mm-hmm. So type 1 is the, they oxidize fat really well. They have the highest density of mitochondria in them. And we know that fat can only be oxidized in the mitochondria, and they don't need to contract as forcefully. So they have a propensity to burn fat. They don't really burn glucose. So you today, you know, we're recording this in my home. Mm-hmm. You walked over here, right?
Yeah, I walked.
Yeah. Good for my example. So, you know, you use those type 1 fibers walking over because they're not going to, you could probably walk for hours and hours and hours and hours before you would fatigue those muscles. Mm-hmm. So those are going to be primarily your fat burning, if you will, muscle fibers because of the high concentration of mitochondria that type 1 fibers have. So then we move into type 2, and type 1 are typically called slow twitch. Type 2 are typically called fast twitch. They're divided into 2A and 2B. So 2A, they have a lower mitochondrial density than their type 1 counterparts, but they can also metabolize glucose. So these are used in steady state cardio. They're used in weight, like resistance training as well. You know, if you go for a run, like when I'm on my bike and I'm doing, you know, kind of a steady state workout, or you're going for a run outside or something, you still have that fat burning, that, you know, you still have that fat oxidation, that beta oxidation, but now you can also use glucose as well. So you can also be using, you know, whether it's glucose from your, you know, stored glycogen or from an external source. Now, type 2B is what is really involved in the sprinting and the high intensity interval training. So these don't actually have a lot of mitochondria in them. They are mainly glycolytic, meaning that they primarily use glucose as their fuel. And when you are doing sprinting, when you are doing, you know, high, like that HIIT workout, you are primarily using these. Now, these are often called anaerobic, and it's a bit of a misnomer. It's not that you're not using oxygen, you're just superseding the mitochondria's ability to use oxygen, so you have to go into different energetic systems. So the one word of caution I want to use, when she was saying she does HIIT 5 times a week, first of all, I think that's, or she was doing it 5 times a week. It's an extraordinary amount of time. And when you are, you know, superseding that aerobic capacity of the mitochondria, if you supersede the glycolytic the glycolytic capacity of those type 2 fibers, so their ability to burn glucose, what ends up happening is you actually stop using all energy systems. What you use is the ATP. So we store a little bit of, like, we have like an emergency fund of ATP in our muscles that are there any given time. There, it's already preformed, doesn't need to go through the Krebs cycle, none of that. You don't have to do any aerobic glycolysis or OxPhos. So it can just, you can just jump into the ATP because it's there, but there's not a lot there. But if you're constantly superseding, if you're constantly tiring out those type 2B fibers, you're not actually burning anything. You're just using the ATP that's in the muscle. So I suspect,
would that contribute to the belly fat that she has, or is
100%, because she's not varying the type of workout that she's doing. So I would, at the very basic, I would say you should be doing HIIT, you know, once or twice a week. If you already have a high stress lifestyle, you know, a steady state workout is going to be really, really great for you. You're going to be moving into those type 2A fibers, or going for a long walk is also really important in terms of beta or fatty oxidation. The other thing is, and this happens all the time with my type A personalities, like my, you know, go-getters, we completely disregard where we are in our menstrual cycle.
Wow. Yeah.
And there's a time and a place for HIIT. And I really, really want to drive this point home, where I want women to really learn how to harness the power of your menstrual cycle, because there are ebbs and flows in terms of hormonal fluctuations, energetic capacity. When we think about the highest points where we have the most energy, it's right around ovulation. Testosterone's high, you know, you're feeling really great. You're probably really sexy. And you're like, let's have lots of sex, lots of fun. That's a really great time to be doing HIIT. When is not a great time to be doing HIIT is leading up to your period, and maybe even the first couple of days of your period, because you are, you know, you're shedding an organ, right? It's taxing. So I know there's another question around menstruation in here somewhere, but I think that learning how to harness the power, A, of your menstrual cycle, and B, recovery. Because if you, all your gains, you know, your nutrition, your physical gains, they all happen in the recovery. It happens when you sleep, and it happens when you have active rest days. So if you don't allow yourself to recover, your body is going to hold onto that fat like an insurance policy. Because you're constantly stressing the body out. Your body's like, when am I going to get a break? I'm trying to shed this organ. I'm not getting the rest and the rejuvenation that I need. I need to hold on to this fat, because this is going to be, you know, I'm in this for the long run.
All right. And you are so correct. The next question actually does talk about women's cycles. So you've talked about the best times in a women's cycle for longer fasts, but can you outline how to know exactly when those parts of the cycles are happening? I.e., I don't have a hard start date of when I start menstruating, because there is about a week of spotting that leads up to her menstrual period.
Did we talk about menstruation on the last AMA. I can't recall.
We did, but I think that we said we were going to go into a deeper dive on it on this episode.
Okay. Okay. Let's do that. Let's do that now. So let me pre-frame this. We're going to talk about the spotting and how to figure out when you're ovulating and when your period starts. But first, let's actually just talk about a normal cycle, because I think we need to establish what normal is first, and then we can compare and contrast. Because I don't think... I was doing a couple months ago now, I was giving a presentation for, you know, a bunch of high functioning female entrepreneurs, and I was talking about their period, and literally they were all like jaws on the ground. They were like, oh my God, that explains so much. And we don't know. We don't actually tap into, we just think we're like, so many of us, we think we're just little men.
Yeah.
And oh, this period is an inconvenient, you know, thing. But if you learn your rhythm and your cycle, you can actually make incredible progress, both as a woman in terms of your metabolism, in terms of your body composition. And you get to know yourself. Like, your period is a vital sign. It is, you know, considered a vital sign for women. So with that being said, let's kind of pretend like your cycle is 28 days, because that really evenly divides into 7, which is a week. Now, if your, you know, normal period is going to be anywhere from like 26, 27 days to 33-ish, like there can be variance here. The week one is your bleed, right? That's your period. That's when your endometrial lining is shedding. And this is a great time. So I think she had said, like, you've talked about this is the best time for a fast, in my opinion, for a woman. Reason being is that your progesterone levels are very low during this time, and so is your estrogen. And progesterone is a very potent appetite stimulant. And we know, like, the week leading up to your period, you're just like, give me all the food. I'm like ravenous. Mm-hmm. So this is a really nice time to fast. It's a nice time to rest. And typically when you're fasting, you're not exerting it, like you're not doing as hard workouts at the gym. So I love a fast during your period week. Week two, so the week post period, we start to see estrogen rising and testosterone rising. This is the best time for a heavy weight workout. We want to profit from the fact that our testosterone is going up. So we want to be able to use testosterone to drive muscle protein synthesis and muscle, like increasing our muscle mass. So I love to do heavy workouts, like super heavy workouts during this time. And you have the capacity for it because you have estrogen and testosterone rising. And I promise you will not turn into She-Hulk. You probably are also going to feel like your libido is like, you're going to be like flirty and, you know, horny, and you're going to want sex. You're going to be chasing it like the animal that you are, because Mother Nature is a wily minx. And she knows that if you have sex around this time, sperm can last for up to 7 days. So if you are kind of, you know, having sex nearing your ovulation and you have a couple of guys, a couple of sperm hanging out up there, then you can fertilize the egg. So again, when we think about, like, you know, and you can use that information in terms of your goals. If you want to fall pregnant, that would be the time for you to have lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of sex. If you do not want a child, then maybe we want to be thinking about other things other than penetration. And again, totally separate podcast.
We're doing that episode though.
That episode is coming. I need to find the guest. I need to find the right guest for that. So midpoint in your cycle is ovulation. Okay. So we have this hormone called luteinizing hormone. I like to call LH the loud uncle that comes over for family dinners. They, you know, and they see you and they're like, "Hey Steph, nice to see you." Whack, you know, hits you on your back, and then you sort of spit out whatever you're eating. That's exactly what happens. So luteinizing hormone is going to basically cause the follicle to spit out the mature egg. And then she's going to hang around for about 24 hours, maybe 48 hours, sort of maximally, waiting around for fertilization. Week three, testosterone drops. Okay, so now the hormonal landscape is changing. That follicle has now changed into something that is called the corpus luteum, and that is going to be secreting progesterone. So now progesterone is the queen of this area of your menstrual cycle. So we see progesterone rising. It peaks at about day 21. Testosterone drops, you're going to see a secondary rise in estrogen. And still a really great time for weights. We just want to be thinking about our energy levels here as well. So maybe your weights are a little bit lighter. They're not as heavy as they were the week before. You could do more reps, lighter weight. Fasting, I've done fasting during this time. I find the week before my period is usually the hardest, because that's when your progesterone is the highest on its way down. And, you know, in that fourth week, if there's no fertilization, like the egg and the sperm have not met, the corpus luteum now is going to degenerate. And the corpus luteum is the thing that's been secreting that progesterone that whole time, like kind of keeping the endometrial lining thick. Mm-hmm. So now without that supply, the endometrial lining is going to become ischemic. It's going to die. And that's, you know, and so the shedding of that is the, you know, the period. And then we start the whole thing over again. Yeah. Now this question was about spotting.
Yeah.
So spotting during the luteal, so in the same way, so when we think about what starts our period, it's that sudden drop in progesterone. The corpus luteum is like, okay, this bitch isn't, this, you know, this girl is not fertilized. Mm-hmm. I'm going to just shed. We got to start this whole thing over again. Mm-hmm. Spotting, the same reason why we have the sudden drop in progesterone that can initiate your menses. If you have temporary drops in progesterone in that luteal phase, in that second phase, you can get spotting. So what that tells me is that this person is, you know, I don't know what her age is, but it's probably that her progesterone levels are low. Mm-hmm. So a couple things that she needs to do. One, she needs to test her progesterone to see what her levels are. If she has a 28-day cycle, mm-hmm. you know, we know that it's highest on day 21, so you need to test it on day 21. But if you have a short luteal phase, so if she's spotting, she shouldn't be testing on day 21. She should be testing 7 days after she ovulates.
Right.
Because that's the highest level that her, like we have ovulation and then 7 days after that is when we're going to have the highest level of progesterone. Now, I think she was saying she actually doesn't know.
Yeah. She's asking, how does she know which cycle she's in? She must bleed a little, think that's the start of her period. And that, so, but it ends up just being spotting. So she wants to know, how does she know what stage, what area of her cycle is she in?
Okay. So this is where we are going to, there's a couple ways that we can do this. One, she can start taking her basal body temperature. So taking her temperature every day, because we know that there are body temperature changes leading up to your period, you're going to be warmer. And then again, right around your ovulation, you're going to see an instant spike in your basal body temperature. So I would get her, you know, invest in a, they're not expensive. They're, I don't know, they're like 20 or 30 bucks or something on Amazon. Get a basal body temperature, take it every single day at the same time and start tracking that over several cycles. Mm-hmm. If she is not so inclined, the other sort of crude measurement is, you know, looking in her knickers, looking in her underwear. She can look at the vaginal discharge that she has. And I just want to preframe this by saying, like, I know that some people are like, oh my God, did she just say discharge? But your vagina is telling you something. Your vagina, like I'm kind of over this idea that we are so embarrassed about our vaginas and like the period is like the worst thing. And like your vagina is a smart, saucy minx. She's trying to tell you something. So listen to her. Mm-hmm. The discharge that you have over the course of the month is going to tell you what's happening internally. So, you know, obviously during your, you know, your period, you're just seeing blood. You're not seeing much discharge. Once your period cessates, once you stop your period, there's going to be kind of like what's called almost like a dry days. You're not really going to see a lot of discharge. But mm-hmm. as you approach ovulation, the amount of discharge increases and it's going to change in its texture. So it's going to kind of almost look like stretchy. It's almost like, you know, sticky. Like you blew, it's sticky, yeah. Like you blew your nose or something. Like that's what it's going to kind of, right before it's going to kind of go from being sort of stretchy to more egg whitey and like translucent. Like you should be able to, if you take your thumb and your finger, be able to like kind of stretch it. Right. That is right before ovulation. And then right after ovulation, it changes again. So you are going to see now that the discharge is going to be more fibrous. It's going to be more, you know, really because it's more difficult for the sperm to kind of pass through. And the amount of fluid is going to decrease quite a bit. So we start to see, you are either going to see you're going to start to see more dry days. So like progesterone actually inhibits the secretion of fluid from the cervix, from the epithelial cells in the cervix. So mm-hmm. as progesterone gets higher and higher, in that second half of your cycle, you're going to see less and less discharge. So you have sort of two dry times, like one is right before your period, one's right after. And then right around ovulation is like that sticky, egg whitey, lotiony, creamy kind of stuff that you see in your underwear. And it kind of gets wetter as the closer you get to ovulation. So she can kind of look in her underwear for some evidence of that. I would constellate that with basal body temperature as well.
I love that. Become your own menstruation detective.
Yes. Chief menstruation detective.
Look for the clues. Okay. Medina from Pennsylvania is asking, what makes some of us emotional all month? 42, so can't be menopausal yet. Can I?
Well, yeah. I mean, maybe when we think about menopause or perimenopause, it can last up to 10 years. So, you know, depending on when your mother went through menopause, you know, genetically we see a very similar pattern. Like when mom went through it is typically when you're going to go through it, like, you know, give or take 2 years on either side. So at 42, we know that, you know, 10 years from that is 52. You're kind of in the drop zone there. So maybe it could also be that you have low progesterone as well. So just like the question previous to this, where it was, I'm getting spotting and whatnot. You could also just have low progesterone because low progesterone after, I should say, if she's 42, after the age of 35, we start to have a stepwise reduction in progesterone. And there's nothing we can do about that. It just happens. Mm-hmm. But you can do things like there's supplements that you can take. So we can go, I'll go over supplements in a second. I just want to say as well, like if she's emotional all month.
Yeah.
Yeah. Before we kind of dive into like, let's be the detective and figure out the progesterone, you know, I would invite her. I don't know how woo-woo this is going to sound, but it is really important. You know, symptoms are your body's way of talking to you. Mm-hmm. And we often stay in our brains all the time. We're often cut off from our soma, from our somatic clues. Mm-hmm. And I would invite her before rushing to fix them, to sit with them for a little bit. Why is she emotional? Mm-hmm. Is there, you know, what is your body trying to tell you? Is there something that you have in your life that is potentially unresolved? Is there a chronic low-grade inflammatory process, you know, whether it's an emotional thing from, you know, 5 minutes ago or 50 years ago or whatever, to just be okay with exploring that? I think that we are so quick to want to get away from feeling bad and get away from feeling sad and that, and we're going to have Dr. Kelly Brogan on the podcast. I'm so excited to have her on. We're going to talk about anger and shame and fear and all these emotions that we are so scared of and we run away from, but they are also part of who you are. It's so important for you to acknowledge them. And the more you ignore them, the bigger the problem is going to become. I would encourage her to just look and sit with them for a little bit. Danielle Laporte talked about shadow work. You know, I think she was episode 4, maybe, or 5.
6, I believe.
She was 6. Okay, yeah. Thank you. So she was talking about shadow work and the importance of going within and shining a light on some of that stuff and having compassion for yourself. Mm-hmm. So I would start there. Pick up her desire planner thing. Yeah. And I don't make any money from, you know, I don't make, you know, not, there's no affiliate money, but it's such a brilliant thing. So that being said, if there is low progesterone, there are some things that she can do. So she can increase the fat in her diet, right? And reduce processed carbs in her luteal phase. This is going to improve her insulin sensitivity, which can directly improve, you know, progesterone levels. When we're thinking about progesterone in particular, if she does in fact have low progesterone, one of the things that we know with low progesterone, and there's like a stepwise reduction, you know, when we're 35 and onward, is there's mood changes. So, you know, you might be more anxious, more irritable. There's like breast tenderness. That's another telltale sign that your progesterone is lowering. Headaches, migraines, weight gain, sex drive. So in terms of, you know, if we're thinking about this in terms of she's doing the emotional work, she's being the self-healer, she's, you know, reparenting herself, and she's accessing, you know, therapies and, you know, self-care initiatives that are going to really help her. Some of the things that she can do from a chemical perspective is we can be looking at, I mean, we talked about stress management, right? Mm-hmm. We can also think about supplementation. So I'll put in the show notes a couple of supplements that I really like and that I use myself. One is, and I'm 42 as well, so this is also a concern for me. I'm just officially newly 42, mm-hmm. newly minted 42-year-old. So zinc and magnesium, most women need more zinc and magnesium than they are getting. So for zinc, you know, the low dose there is going to be like 5 to 10 milligrams. And I would be taking that prophylactically, like on the daily. And for magnesium, the standard dose is somewhere between 200 and 400 milligrams. I will go up as high as like 800 milligrams with a woman, especially if she's experiencing like premenstrual, like right before her period. She's, you know, she's moody and she's irritable and she's bloated and all those kinds of things. So those would be where I would start. And when we are magnesium deficient, of course, that's going to increase your blood pressure. It's going to reduce your glucose tolerance and it's going to cause sort of neural excitation. So I actually really like to take magnesium in the evening. If she's having a hard time falling asleep, she's finding that she's very emotional in the evening. Mm-hmm. Magnesium in the evening is very much it brings the excitation in the neurons down a little bit, allows you to fall asleep. Another really great thing for someone who is low on progesterone would be Vitex, or the word is chaste tree berry. It acts very similarly to dopamine in that it reduces prolactin levels, which can also be a cause of low. If you have very high prolactin levels, mm-hmm. that can lower your progesterone. So again, standard dose there, 150 to 250 milligrams, and that will help with the headaches, the migraines, and many of the symptoms that we see leading up to, you know, those like premenstrual syndrome or symptoms that we see in the week leading up to menstruation. And then just simply like fat, man, like you got to eat fat. You know, fat is not going to directly increase your progesterone, but it is, if you can increase your fat, and I would also say protein in the week leading up to your period, you're going to improve your insulin sensitivity, which is going to, of course, improve your progesterone levels, like I said. And ladies with PCOS, this is particularly important for them. They need to cut out the carbs.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I know that that's a bit of a long and varied response, but I would definitely say for her, looking at having the courage to lean into the emotions and why they're causing her such distress all the time, all month long. I mean, I would just hate for that to be someone's existence, because it's all month, every month. So I would go back and listen to Danielle Laporte. When Kelly Brogan's on, she should definitely be listening to Dr. Brogan. And a couple other people that we have sort of in the lineup that we're trying to get in for the podcast in 2020 who are going to be really important for that.
All right. So now is when I get to ask you my question. I have two teenage girls at home. I have a 15 and 16 year old. And this top every day they come home, "Mom, my friend went on birth control. She, you know, she only bleeds three to four days now instead of 5 to 6 days. My friend went on birth control for this reason, for that reason." It's constant. So my question is, what are your thoughts on the birth control pill for teenagers? And what are the long-term effects?
Okay, so I consider your daughters my nieces. Mm-hmm. Like, I love them. But this is true for all girls. And I am not going to mince my words here, because I feel very strongly about this. So first, if they haven't listened to my conversation with Dr. Jolene, they should. It was like two episodes because it was so long. I would definitely listen to her. Now, I know that, you know, I know your girls, and maybe not, maybe they're rolling their eyes. And I'm like, ugh, I'm not going to listen to whatever. So I want to start off by saying that when you look at the data on the birth control pill, the symptoms, the risks that you are putting yourself under, they are so unbelievable that it shocks. It is shocking to me that women will put up with this crap. Mm-hmm. And I will go in so far as to say that, you know, people will say, "Oh, women's lib, and it allows us to." No, this is anti-woman. Mm-hmm. The pill is anti-woman. And I know I will get blowback for that, but please, if you could just have an open heart and an open mind, let me just kind of lay out my argument for you. So when we think about when I was speaking to Dr. Brighton, when I was speaking to Jolene about the pill, and this is not just the pill, this is just hormonal contraception. Okay, so I'll say the pill, but what I mean is hormones, right? Hormones that are preventing pregnancy. There's a couple of different things, important things that it does. It's not just that you only get your period for 3 days, which, by the way, is not an actual period. This is a fake period. You're not actually bleeding. It affects your metabolism. It is pro-inflammatory. So you are very likely to get swollen and puffy. And I'm going to try to talk about this in a way that the teenagers are going to listen to me. Like, you're going to get kind of fat. Like you're gonna very much be, it upregulates something called the NF-kappa-B pathway, which is very, very pro-inflammatory. And there's also cytokines and things that are upregulated there as well. And it's also going to increase your cholesterol synthesis. So things like your LDL, your low density lipoproteins. So when you pair those two things together, you're inflamed and you have hypercholesterolemia, you have hyperlipidemia. This is a recipe for cardiovascular and cerebrovascular incident. This is a risk for heart attacks and for stroke. I'm not saying anything new. This is in the insert. Like if you look at the insert and the packaging, there is a marked increase or marked risk for stroke and heart attacks. And part of that is because you are upregulating these inflammatory pathways and you are upregulating low density lipoproteins and this atherogenic behavior in the arteries. So, you know, in terms of teenage talk, I would say you're going to get puffy, swollen, and you're probably going to gain weight on it. It also depletes something called CoQ10, which is a really important antioxidant. And your teenager might not really care about this, but I would say this is going to accelerate your aging. Mm-hmm. When we think about your skin, even just, I mean, aging in general, right? Like, you know, we could think about aging of the cell, aging of the organs, aging of the tissues, aging of the system. Let's just talk about what teenagers care about, which is their skin. You are going to see a change in hydration, skin thickness, elasticity, and visible wrinkles when you gobble up all your CoQ10. Wow. It affects your brain. So there was a really big, it was Denmark. There was a huge study in Denmark. They looked at 1 million women living in Denmark on the pill. And what they found was there was an increased risk for first use of an antidepressant, meaning the first time that they were prescribed an antidepressant was coming after they were prescribed the pill, and a first diagnosis of depression, which was found across all types of hormonal constant contraception. And it was the highest among adolescents. Mm-hmm. So the teenagers are girls, right? Like your girls, like your incidence of mood. Teenagers are already moody AF, right? They're already moody. This is going to increase their, you know, swings, and it's going to lead them to oscillate more towards depression. You know, sexual health. This is actually where Jolene and I were talking about this, I thought this was really, what's the word I want to use? Ironic, because all that CoQ10 that's being gobbled up, you have this propensity towards rhabdomyolysis, which is basically muscle pain and weakness. So when we think about this in terms of the vagina, you know, painful sex, poor lubrication, vaginal wall atrophy, pelvic floor muscles, which are really important in order for you to have an orgasm, you need to have strong pelvic floor, you know, painful sex, all this kind of stuff. So your libido drops. So people get on the pill thinking, oh my God, now I can have all this sex and not worry about a baby. But what ends up happening is you actually want less sex. Your libido tanks, your testosterone tanks. So it changes your constitution, your moods, the way that you look at sex. You don't want it because it's painful. If you can't properly lubricate, you know, the internal walls of the vagina, and your muscles are atrophying, and you know, you don't even want sex to begin with, like who's going to?
I think I've read that you can't even pick up on pheromones that you would normally think are very attractive. You can't, there have been women who have been on the pill for 10 years, gone off the pill, and then said, oh, wow, my husband stinks. Like, I don't like the smell of him, because you weren't able to pick it up appropriately.
Thank you so much. I forgot about that. You're right. So that changes something called your major histocompatibility complex, or your MHC. Your ability to smell. So women, I think it's called the t-shirt test. So they would, women on the pill and women off the pill, they gave them t-shirts that like men had slept in, and women who were not on the pill selected, they were like, oh, this t-shirt smells good. They were selecting men who were the most genetically dissimilar to them. So that's actually what you want. You want to be able to choose someone with a different genetic pool than yours so that you can have the healthiest possible offspring. Mm-hmm. The women who were on the pill chose different men than those women who were off the pill chose. Mm-hmm. And they chose men that were more genetically similar to them. Mm-hmm. So this is kind of, you know, Jolene put this, like the way that she had framed it was, it's almost like choosing your cousin. which is kind of gross. And then, you know, to your point, there have been many women who have been on the pill, you know, courted, mated, married, you know, their husbands had children, you know, and got off the pill because they wanted to procreate, they wanted to have children. And then they were like, God, this mm-hmm. guy's like, I am not attracted to this guy's smell. Mm-hmm. So it really does, you know, so one of the things that she said was like, you know, it's okay to, you know, if you want to be on the pill, like, you know, it's a free world. Like you're able to make, you know, as long as you have an informed consent around it, but just make sure that before you marry your mate, you go off the pill for at least 6 months before and see if you're still attracted to him. So for your girls, or for any mom who's listening, who has teenage girls, you know, the thing with teenagers is that they know everything, right? Oh, so everything. Yeah. Everything. I mean, we're stupid, old, you know, whatever. We're old goats. They have no idea. So I would say for disease prevention, I would definitely be talking to them about condoms. Mm-hmm. And if we are thinking about contraception, so not wanting to fall pregnant, I would see if they can tolerate a copper IUD, mm-hmm. Which is not hormonal. So it's not gonna, and so some women, like, you either love it or you hate it, but you kind of have to go into it and sort of test it out and see if that works for you. And I would actually get them to be very familiar with their own cycle in the same way that, you know, we're educating 42-year-old and, you know, the women that have asked these questions for this podcast. I would actually like to start a little bit earlier and get our teenagers really in tuned or attuned with their cycle. So they can use things like, you know, I'll link this out in the show notes, something called DAISY, which is like a fertility awareness method. It's a basal body temperature tracker. And you just basically take your temperature every day and it tells you whether you're close to ovulating, whether you're ovulating, are you, you know, able to get pregnant right now or not. I would actually get the girls to really understand their cycles first. Mm-hmm. And if they do have things like painful periods or acne or, you know, gobs and gobs of blood in their, you know, on their pads or their DAISY cup or whatever they're using, that's an invitation to kind of look at where the hormonal imbalance might be. The pill is not going to do that. The pill is not going to fix it. No. It's going to cover up the symptoms. And, you know, if we were to say, like, imagine if you, the reason why the pill exists for the, and this is why I say that the pill is anti-female, because there's a reason why there's no male equivalent to the pill. If I said to a guy, mm-hmm. listen, you're not going to get your girlfriend pregnant. You can have all the sex you want, but you take this pill, it's going to shut down your brain's connection with your testes. You're likely going to get depressed. You're going to lose muscle mass because your testosterone is going to tank. You're going to increase the risk for a heart attack, a stroke. And once you come off it, your sperm, your guys, they're probably going to be affected. What guy is going to say okay to that?
None.
There was a joke I was reading that, you know, the male pill, the male equivalent of the pill is like 5 years away from being offered to the public. And it's been that way for the past 40 years. You know, like it's just never, like, we assume as females so much risk, heart attack, stroke, CoQ10, like testosterone, mood, depression, like all these things for what? If you just harness if you understand your cycle, you only have a couple days during the entire month where you're actually fertile. So if you understand what those days are and you play around with days that you know, like we said before, whether you're, you know, there's penetration or not, you can have a really healthy, robust sex life and not cut your brain off from your ovaries. Mm-hmm. And the bigger problem I have with adolescents is they are still growing up. So, you know, 16 and 14, like their frontal lobe, their skeleton, you know, skeleton and the brain tend to go hand in hand. Like the maturity is not there yet. So you give them an exogenous medication that they grow up with essentially. Right. We don't know what's going to happen after they're off.
It could be 15 years. If, you know, if Haley goes on now, 15, that could be 15 years of a birth control pill.
And there are no long-term studies demonstrating efficacy, none. So it is a gamble and a risk. So Haley, if you're listening, please get the DAISY and learn your cycle and we can have a chat. But, and any other mom with girls where you're going through this conversation, I'm not even getting into like the disruption of the mitochondria, the vaginal microbiome, the microbiome of our guts, you know, it alters everything. And we are not, if we are anything, we are houses for our bacteria. We are houses for our microbiota. And if we cannot protect our bacterial lineage because we are destroying it with a pill, we are endangering our future daughters and our future women. That is why I say the pill is anti-woman. So, yeah.
I love that. Thank you so much. Okay, so those are all great questions. We have one more from Nikki. How do you prioritize fixing certain hormones? Example, if blood work or testing or assessment say you have like 10 things to fix so you feel healthier, how do you know where to start?
Okay, so this is kind of going back to what we were talking about at the beginning, this idea of this mechanistic thing where we can just pull, like, where do we start with the hormones? Well, we have to start with all of them. You cannot pull out one hormone in isolation and think that you are only fixing that one. You are going to be affecting the entire system. So I always, you know, hormonal dysregulation is like a cacophony of, it's a symphony. It's this concerto of events that is, you can never just start with one. So what I would start with for anybody, and I know who's asking this question, so I'm going to tailor it a little bit to her. Mm-hmm. I would start with working on cellular grit. And it's not just for her. This is really for anybody listening, but I just happen to know who's asking this question. And I made this term up. I was talking to Dr. David Sinclair, and I was like, he was talking about sirtuin activation and the genomic instability. And I'm like, so what you really want is cellular grit. And he was like, did you just make that up? And I was like, I did indeed, sir. So I'm just going to go with that term. So you want to be engaging in activities that are going to make you stronger from the cells up. So first thing is going to be sleep. And I know in particular, this person has trouble with sleep, but doubling down on sleep is going to be such an important, you know, John asked this before about sleep optimization and hormones. Sleep is cheap. It's free. It's available to everybody. We all need it. And it is one of the most balancing things that we can do in terms of rejuvenating things. So if we just start with your circadian biology, your circadian rhythm first, get 8 hours of sleep, do it for a week and tell me how you feel. Like, do you remember we had that coffee? You were saying this earlier today when you came over. We had this, sometimes we have superhero coffees where we just have these like awesome people coming over. And what were you telling me? The phrase that everybody was using?
It was, you don't know how bad it was until it's good.
Yeah. And the same, I think that applies to sleep. You don't know how bad it felt going on 6 hours of sleep until you get eight. Until you feel the energy and the rejuvenative properties that having 8 hours of proper sleep can give you. So I'd start off with sleep, and then I'd start maybe with nutrition. So when we think about some of the things that are the most disruptive in general, when we think about the North American population, I don't remember the stat, but it's like at least half, I think it's 70%. Somebody fact check me on this, but I think it's 70% of the American population is considered obese now. Mm-hmm. And part of that is because we are having so many processed carbohydrates, easy sugar, and sugar is poison, man. Like, you know, it is just going to, the constant bathing of your cells, the constant aggregation of blood glucose is just, it is so destructive to hormonal regulation. So I would like to, if we're starting with cellular grit, first is sleep. Second is TRE, so time-restricted eating. And we talked about this in the last Ask Me Anything. So at least 12 hours. So over time, you're going to tighten it to eight. A likely weaning off of sugar, right? So we want to be weaning people off of sugar because what happens when we eat more sugar is we want more sugar. And when we eat more sugar, then we want more sugar. And so the vicious, you know, kind of cycle propagates itself. So I'd start one and two there. And then I would kind of work on, this is particularly true for women, men, it's true for men too, but you got to build muscle. Ladies, you got to build your muscle mass, especially if you are thinking about healthy aging. It increases your carbohydrate tolerance. It increases your functional movement. You know, you want to lift up your grandkids, you have to have upper body strength. You want to be able to travel and put your, you know, luggage in the overhead bin, you have to have shoulder, chest, back stability, core stability. So building muscle for me is important because I lump the muscular system in with the musculoskeletal system. So your bones and your muscles, they talk to each other all the time. The more muscles you have, the denser your bones are going to be. There's a positive and on the flip side, a negative. Like the more muscle you have, the denser your bones are. The less muscle you have, you know, we are at risk for low bone density and things like fractures and instability. Yeah, it would be muscles. It would be muscles and sort of, you know, movement therapy that would come after that. So I know that that's kind of a lot of things all at once, but just start with the simple stuff, you know, like start with a cold shower, start with skipping breakfast, start with a good sleep. And that is really going to drive the hormonal balance that you want. And that's going to help with your energy, right? Remember, energy is all it is like substrate availability, endogenous and exogenous, hormonal regulation. So what you're eating and lifestyle stuff and your enzymatic, you know, change of your enzymes over time. So, and which is kind of a genetic and or an epigenetic expression. So I hope that that's helpful for her.
I think it will be. What a great topic. What a great way to spend an afternoon. I've enjoyed this thoroughly. Thank you so much, Dr. Stephanie. I don't think we have the topic picked for our next AMA yet, unless you know it. Do you?
No, not at this time. Right. So we'll post it in the Facebook community and we'll see what people, I know posture and rehab was a big one. I think rituals and rhythms were a big one, but I can't recall which was which. So we'll kind of just do another poll and see what people want to hear.
Great. So if you want to join our Facebook group, you can go to bettershow.co and it'll link there. Yeah. Thank you so much for spending the day with me.
Awesome. This has been great. My voice has been getting lower and lower and lower as we've been talking. I now have the phone voice. Now
I've drank all the liquids while we've been talking.
All right. We'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. You can find all this information at our website, bettershow.co. That's BETTERSHOW.co. Maybe the simplest way to keep in touch with me is to sign up for my email. When you go to bettershow.co, there'll be a little pop-up and I send a weekly email on all things mindset, nutrition, fitness, longevity, aging, things that are capturing my attention that week in a newsletter that we call Brain Candy. You can find me on social, on Twitter, it's Dr_Stephanie. On Instagram, I am Dr. Stephanie Estima. That's STEPHANIE ESTIMA. And finally, a legal and medical disclaimer. This podcast is for general information only, and the advice, discussions, and recommendations that we discuss on this podcast do not replace medicine, chiropractic, or any other primary healthcare professional's advice or care. There is no doctor-patient relationship that has been established in the consumption of this podcast, and the use and implementation of the information contained here are at the sole discretion of the listener. The content in this podcast is not intended to be used as a substitute for any professional advice, diagnosis, or treatment.